Welcome to Kingdom Roots, where we talk about how the kingdom took root then and how it's taking root now with Scott McKnight. And today on our show, we have Lynn Kohick with us. We're very excited, and she is coming to Northern Seminary in a few months, and we're very excited to have her join our community. And Scott is going to give her a little bit of an introduction, and then we'll dive into our conversation with her.
Okay, well, Lynn, we're really glad that you're with us, and we welcome you to the Kingdom Roots podcast. Lynn is a friend of mine. I've known her as a New Testament colleague for maybe 15 years.
A long time. I think when we were children. Don't start giving dates right now, Scott.
and I have followed her work. I just think that her book on women in the early churches is a fantastic book. It's a contribution to scholarship and has to be read by all serious New Testament students. And Lynn and I have the distinct privilege of replacing F.F. Bruce's commentaries. I think Bruce wrote Colossians and Ephesians in one volume and probably did it in 2 months. And it took Lynn and I a long time to complete the work. Although we can say we wrote more words than Professor Bruce did. But Lynn, we want to welcome you to the Kingdom Roots podcast, and especially to the Northern Seminary community.
Oh, thank you. Thank you both, Scott and Laura. I'm excited to both talk with you now and to be joining the Northern team in a couple of months, starting in January. Yeah.
What are you excited about coming to Northern, Lynn?
Well, you mentioned my earlier work on women in the ancient world, including in the early church. And one of the opportunities I have is to start an MA program in women's studies. And so I'm very excited to launch that, and we'll be working on that in the next couple of months.
And the number of students who've said things to me, and I'm sure to Laura, because she's closer, her ear is closer to the ground than mine is, pretty exciting. Students are really excited to have you on campus. But
yeah.
Lynn, writing a commentary looks like it's such an easy thing to do. And a lot of young professors say, oh, I'd love to write a commentary on Matthew. I was that professor. And I worked on it for 3 years. I wrote 2 chapters, and I wrote to Gordon Fee. And I said, Gordon, will you let me out of this contract? I will never finish this commentary. Because writing a commentary is a grind. It's daily work where it's not like you're writing a novel where some story starts to unfold and you know what's coming next. And it's not like writing even an academic monograph where you do know what's coming next. It's just every word starts over again. You got to consider how this word is used. And I have to say, I am pretty amazed at what you accomplished in your Ephesians commentary as an administrator. I know how much work it was for me, and I'm a person who is a moron when it comes to administration, or at least someone who does everything I can to avoid it. So here you are as an administrator, grinding away. And I would just like to hear you talk about how you wrote this thing.
Yeah, well, I hope it'll be true at Northern, but I'm not sure. But when I did administrative work, both at Wheaton College and at Denver, I had really good colleagues that didn't bother me, Scott, okay?
Oh, I won't
bother. Sorry, that was just a softball and I had to swing at it. Writing the commentary, as you say, that it is a grind. There is the, but there's also consistency or, like I worked on a verse or two a day for a long time. And I just said to myself every morning, I'm more of a morning person than a night owl. And so before work, whether it was an hour and a half, I would do that one verse, doing the kinds of things, the syntactical kinds of things, the word studies that you're talking about. But then on weekends, I would spend several hours, both on weekends, trying to carve out a larger chunk of time to be able to actually get through a passage. And the last year when I had already done the draft, and now I was going back through and making changes, responding to the editor and that sort of thing, I charted out how much time I would need to spend each week. And I think it averaged 5 hours on Saturday and 5 hours on Sunday for like 7 months straight, mm-hmm. plus 1 to 2 hours in the morning before work in order to keep my pace. So yeah, it was a grind. I have to say, in all of that, there were only a few times, praise the Lord, where I really thought, I want to throw Ephesians out the window, because it's such a lovely book. It was wonderful to be steeped in it, even though it took a lot of time.
Well, you know, a letter of Paul complicates life, because you have the big ugly uncle looking at you every time, and it's Romans. And what it seems like everything revolves around Romans. No, you can kind of deal with 1 Corinthians and 2 Corinthians, but Romans has all that theology that is at work also in some ways in Ephesians, not so much in Colossians. So I had the easier task on that. So I'm wondering, theologically, pastorally, ecclesiologically, personally, what were some of the growth points for you, learning points, exciting things that I know we've talked before about your Philippians and how enjoyable that was as a piece of work. What are some of the highlights there for Ephesians for you?
I think with Ephesians, it allowed, I really enjoyed getting into Paul's Trinitarian theology. Because he uses Father, Son, and Holy Spirit all over the place, and it's just there. And at least I was trained to really avoid, when looking at Paul's work is from an historical perspective, to avoid thinking theologically. And I would say Wes Hill's book on Paul and the Trinity was such a big help for me. And then I just kind of embraced, if this is what Paul is saying, he's doing this. He's using this language. I'm not imposing it, but what can I understand from it? I would say that was a lot of fun to explore.
You know, I recently read Matthew Bates, The Birth of the Trinity. Well, first Wesley Hill, Matthew Bates, and then Madison Pierce has a new academic monograph on the book of Hebrews. And I believe that these three scholars, they're not alone, are making a significant contribution that is shifting, it should shift scholarship away. I grew up with what you did, Len, is that Trinitarian thought is verboten. You're supposed to stay out of that stuff and just describe what the New Testament says. And what Wesley Hill actually shows is that Jimmy Dunn, in his famous book, Christology in the Making, which was written just before I went to study with Jimmy Dunn, and then Larry Hurtado in Lord Jesus Christ, and also Richard Baucom, they were all persuaded that we can't talk about New Testament view of God unless we keep it restricted to Jewish monotheism. And these three scholars, Wes Hill, and Matthew Bates and Madison Pierce, are saying, now, wait a minute, you've ruled off the map what might be on the map. And if you don't see it on the map because you're not looking for it, you won't be able to factor it in. So I'm really glad that you brought up Trinitarian thinking, because I agree. I think that it's earlier. I mean, it's not Nicene. It's not Chalcedonian, but it is, you know, there's a relationality between Father, Son, and Spirit. You got them all three talking in the book of Hebrews. So go ahead. No.
So that was something that I had not previously really dealt with and delved into, but that was fun. And then I would say I also really enjoyed exploring the historical backdrop of the household codes. Of course, I've done a lot on women in the ancient world, but Ephesians also, I mean, you have to deal with the institution of slavery. And of course, you do that in your commentary on Philemon. There's so much rich hermeneutical works out there that are asking us to think in terms of interpretation, not just historically, which is important, but then also how did this book live in the Christian community, especially in the United States in recent centuries. So that also was challenging in a good way. I hope it's profitable for readers.
You know, I've seen a trend in some New Testament scholarship that Paul just caved in Ephesians and gave in to the Aristotelian social codes and lost steam, you know, sort of like a scholar at the end of a career no longer has any good ideas and they just keep pumping out the same idea. Did you say much about that? When I did Colossians, I would look at what they were saying and think, nah, this isn't the same as Aristotle.
No, I do mention Aristotle because I think the categories are his, but they've morphed over the 500 years till they come to Paul. But nevertheless, Paul's audience would also have an expectation. I mean, that's just what their framework was, and so they're going to think in these categories. And Paul believes the gospel can address anything in your life. And so if this is how your culture is shaping things, well, I can bring the gospel into that conversation. And I think that's what he tries to do. But then he challenges the underlying premise of those hierarchical categories. And that's where you hear the gospel speaking. So yeah, I don't think he runs out of steam. I think it is subversive. It's subversive even to the point that it's read aloud. So yeah. The wives are hearing this letter with their husbands and Paul's command for husbands to love their wives. And no one else is talking about the kind of love that husbands should have for their wives, the self-giving love that Christ modeled. No one is talking about that.
Yeah.
And Paul doesn't say it privately in a men's retreat. Hey guys, you know, I really think it'd be helpful, you know, to love your wives this way. It's public.
Yeah.
And the same with the slaves. They hear Paul say that God shows no favoritism. And so it's public, it's transparent. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's powerful.
You know, Northern has an emphasis in New Testament studies because of Bill Scheel on the performance, of the letter. And when I did Colossians, Lynn, the words that stuck out for the slaves for me is treat them equally and justly or rightly. Those are strong terms, that word equally. And I think, I bet those slaves were clapping when they heard that, oh boy, people are going to have to live up to this one. This is a strong one. And, Lynn, okay,
yeah.
This is a slider. You know, I know you like baseball, so I can bring this up. You were the first woman to write a commentary in the NIC New Testament series. This series has been going on for 70 years, I think. I think the earliest ones are right there about 1950. Do you think that there were things that you saw that maybe other people haven't seen or aren't seeing, or you know, anything like that?
I would say so. I think New Testament studies, a lot of my peers and even some younger scholars did the semester in Germany, or became very proficient in German, for example. And my path just didn't include that, and there were fewer women that were doing studies, and my husband had a full-time job. He wasn't going to be able to pick up and go to Germany. And there is a aspect of I don't know, it can be, I have felt at times it's kind of a defining club. And I just don't draw on German scholarship of the early 1900s. I think in a way that I've seen a lot of other commentaries draw on. And instead, what I try to do in this commentary was pull as many female commentary writers as I felt would be useful, including those that may be much more progressive than what the commentary series itself does, and of course what I affirm as well. But just because I thought it was important to have women's voices as part of the conversation. So I and I'm used to talking with them. And so even some of these women that might seem really progressive, we chat in the ladies' room in between sessions at SBL, and they're my friends, even if we don't share always theological views. They're people to me, and so I think that that relational piece probably comes through, at least in my commentary. As I, when I'm reading other commentaries and other books in my study for writing it, I feel that they are my conversation partners, and so I think that would be one thing that I would bring just kind of naturally as a woman author. But I think there might be other places, I hope there are other places where someone just reading along thinks, oh, this author is a good New Testament scholar.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Well, I've found over the years that the people, it really matters who you decide to interact with. And there's a sense in which you're writing a commentary, you're supposed to interact with everything. Well, it doesn't take very long to realize that's impossible. There is so much stuff written that you'll never see and don't have time to interact with. And even if you did, you're not going to say anything about it. And so your choice of conversation partners is really matter. Really matters. So, all right, now you bring up women's scholarship. Lynn, you're probably known as one of the leading, if not the leading, New Testament scholar on women in the New Testament period. And I know there's a new book by, is it Susan Hyland? Hyland? And it's not as good as yours, but it's a little book.
I don't know about that.
It's a littler book. And I know Nijay's worked on, I've taught some of these topics. I'd like you to describe a little bit about what that work is, because this isn't one of these devotional studies. It's a world-opening experience. It's sort of like you have gone to about 15 diaspora communities and thrown open the door and said, this is what's going on inside the house. So give us some highlights of that book, and then I'm going to ask you to tell us who your favorite woman in the New Testament is.
Okay. Well, I have to give credit on this journey to my second reader, Ross Kramer, who was at Penn for a long time. She did her dissertation on women in the Greco-Roman world at Princeton with John Gager. And Ross then went up to Brown. She is retired from there. But Ross's work, she is just so careful. She asks fearless questions of the text. And we don't share the same presuppositions. But her book called Her Share of the Blessing was one I tried to use in my classes because it opened up, I felt, the world of the first century in terms of women. But what happened was the students, they rightly picked up her different presuppositions, but they tripped over those. And so I thought, what if I took her example of diving into the historical material, but I framed it in a key that was more consistent with my own presuppositions? Would that open up her great work and others? There are other women, Bernadette Bruton, for example. I remember her writing her book. She looked at inscriptions and was the first woman to really challenge this idea that when you see a woman leader of the synagogue title, that wasn't honorary. It may have actually been for real, you know. And I remember meeting her in my grad school days, and you know, it was fun. I was at the beginning of this movement of women exploring women in the ancient world. So so that is kind of how my interest developed and was encouraged. And I love how you describe that I opened doors for people to see a community of both men and women and how women were functioning. That's a great image. And that was truly what I was hoping to do with this.
Okay, so some highlights of the book. What are some things that you say? Anybody, a lot of people who read this book say, wow, I had no idea about this. I can tell you, a number of our students have read your book. They really like it. So what are the things that you hear that people say, this really illuminated the text for me?
I think overall, people are just amazed at what women were doing. Women were just doing a lot, right? And I think that people just, that there's this horrible phrase, barefoot and pregnant. But I think people really felt like, yeah, that's what women were. They just kept having kids and they were stuck at home. And you know, even from an economic standpoint, no one except the very wealthy had the luxury to not work. So you were always doing stuff. But I would say overall, that was the thing I think that hit people. And then I would say secondly and relatedly, the influence that women had on their wider culture. So a lot of women had had money. You know, Mary Magdala was a sponsor or patron of Jesus. She had the ability to spend her money the way she wanted to. And that's new for people. I think they impose a more Victorian model on the ancient world and think that women, once they married, they gave all their money to their husbands, and that just wasn't the case. Also that women could give money to others. They could be patrons and benefactors themselves. And so that, I think just that sense of agency also is something that readers will comment with me on. And then I think in the book, Women in the World of the Earliest Christians, initially I had said, I'll do one chapter on marriage. And as I delved into the resources and the material, I realized I actually need two chapters. I need one chapter that describes the ideal marriage, and I need another chapter that looks at the resources we have on actual marriages, because they don't always line up. And I think there are other, women will say, in one way or another, the fact that I parse out what is rhetorical and idealized from what was actually happening is a real help at a variety of levels, including understanding marriage, because that's an institution that we have as well today. So,
okay, some quick questions. Was Junia an apostle?
Yeah, I think there is a very good chance that she was. And you know, she's not one of the 12, nor is Paul one of the 12. But I think she carried authority in the congregation, and high authority in the congregation. Yeah.
Priscilla. What about Priscilla?
Well, I think she was really smart. And I think Paul realized she was really smart. And he was happy to have her train one of his other co-workers, Apollos, because she was that. And you know what, that was okay. Paul would have seen this kind of stuff in other places. In some way she had education. And that doesn't come cheap at this time. So when you have those things, and when you have some sort of resource, there's an expectation that you use that for the benefit of the community. And so she can function as a mother of the city or a mother of the community and give of her resources and her talents in a way that doesn't make her either an odd bird or a renegade or an anomaly. It's just, this is how the community functioned. And I think that might be another, to go back to your earlier question, that might be something that I learned in writing this book, is that women were understood not only through the lens of gender, but also class and economic status, social status, and all of those things played a role. And they do today as well. So that's kind of a similarity. But when we tend to just sort of think male, female, and just the gender question, I think we miss out on the complexity of what was going on in the ancient city.
One of my favorite New Testament women is Phoebe. And, I've written a little bit. I've imagined my way into her life a little bit, but that's all right. I tell people I'm imagined. I think she was the reader of the letter. And if she wasn't, she probably told somebody how to read the letter. So she exercised, this is amazing to me. I first learned this from Rita Finger. Do you know Rita?
Yeah. I do know her, yes.
Yeah.
Know of her. I mean, I don't have a, friendship with her, but I know of her, yes.
I first learned it from her, and I was a young New Testament professor, and I'm reading this thinking, whoa, this is an interesting idea. And then, of course, Bob Julik makes a bit of a deal of this. But Phoebe, what was her position? And, one of my questions, do you think she was a deacon?
Yes. And I think the big thing is, that when any of these titles are used in the New Testament, we cannot just overlap them onto current contemporary church polity. It just doesn't work easily that way, I don't think. But I hate for people to get tied up in knots about how to transpose it today. What I would much rather say is that these women who are identified as leaders. And I'm going to add Yodia and Syntyche in Philippians. They had enough influence in the Christian community that what they said mattered. And what they said mattered to Paul's other co-workers, to Paul himself, and to everybody else in the community. And so however you then arrange your church today, I think being biblical would be allowing that same sort of thing to happen out, whatever labels you're going to put on it. I guess that's how I try and navigate. Yeah.
But Phoebe also is a person of wealth. Mm-hmm. And, probably was like a patron of the Pauline mission when he's in, I would guess, in Corinth as well as Cenchrea, probably together, don't you think?
I do. I do. Yeah. Yes. And it's expensive to even write letters. I mean, Paul's ministry was an expensive enterprise, and travel was not easy to do. And so he relied on people helping him, as did a lot of people at this time. Paul's a public speaker. There are other public speakers, pagan speakers, Jewish speakers at the time. They all rely on people helping them out.
Yeah. So, well, our listeners are going to be excited about reading some of your work, your new commentary on Ephesians. And it got a lot of interest on my blog when I mentioned, or whatever it was on Twitter or something. Boy, really excited about that. And on your studies on women, we didn't get to the other one you wrote is with Amy Hughes. You know, we'll just tell students to come to Northern and they can, people can come to Northern and study with you. But we're really excited about you coming and so excited that you spent time with us today. We look forward to your arrival. And I know our students are just so excited to meet you and to get to know you. So thank you, Lynn, for being with us. And one of your students will be Laura Terrell, and I will do all I can to keep her as my TA so that she doesn't abscond and take off and become yours. But
we can talk about this offline, right, Laura? We'll talk about it offline.
There you go. Talk more. I just have to say, I am super excited. And I do know there was quite a buzz when the announcement was made that you were coming to Northern. And I think we are really looking forward to learning more about the role that women played in the early church, in the earliest Christian church, and to think about what that means for us now and how to move forward. I think Carrie was saying last night in a webinar, what are the redemptive possibilities for women and men in the context of leadership in the church? And I think that's such a fun thing to think about, and to think about how to be an example to the world of God's purposes for men and women relating to one another in the context of the family of the church. So I'm excited to have you come and to help us learn more about how to put that into practice. So, well, thank you all for joining us for some time together on Kingdom Roots, where we look at how the kingdom took root then and how it's taking root now. And we will be back in a few weeks with more to share with you all. Thank you.